Hey folks, Mark here. Sunsung.
Sunsung, intellectual edition.
Intellectual edition. Chris has got his glasses on, Irvin.
Mate, I've got my glasses on and I am ready to pay back into the giant podcast karmic, what's the word, balance, universal balance, you know, because it's all very well that we spend most of our time in this podcast slinging shit at bands like Health, and I have frankly a really good time doing exactly that, but...
You've sometimes got to have a bad time.
Yeah, sometimes you've got to pay back and actually do some proper journalism. So I've got my glasses on. This week we've got references, like actual referencing.
I think, and also this week we're falling into that increasingly popular subcategory of podcaster, which is white men talking about war. White middle-aged men talking about wars.
That's popular, is it?
Well, that's something, I think you either get really into craft beers or you get really into war as you get older. Like, I think it's like one of only two things.
You'd think the two of them would probably meet at some point. Here we are being intellectual, funnily enough. You know who doesn't tend to do very well in some authoritarian regimes? Intellectuals. People with glasses.
Craft beer drinker.
There's not a lot of that in North Korea right now.
Yeah.
We're not going to faff about too much at the start of this week, Mark. We've got a lot to get through. This is the Turbo Folk episode. And what a fucking title. Folk mixtape.
It's like the biggest misnomer in the world, isn't it?
Aye, there should be some kind of accuracy in advertising, trading standards and inquiry into this.
I think it's like somebody that kind of thinks they know English, you know? Because I mean, I suppose we'll get into this in a wee second, but it did start off as it is kind of folky in the earliest days, and then it somehow is still called that, even though it's not.
I don't mind the name. I just think it always gets an expression when people ask, oh, what are you doing this week? What?
Yeah. Turbo what?
So very quickly, okay, so this week we have frankly an inordinate amount of work to this episode. This is the hardest I've worked on an episode that I can remember because I wanted to get it right. And if you like what our podcast is doing, you can, support the podcast in a number of ways. The lowest tier, Mark?
Is £4 or four of whatever your local currency is per month. What would that be in Serbia?
Bullets.
Four bullets, yeah.
Maybe at a time. Not now. A lovely place.
But yeah, basically you can support the podcast for that minimal amount per month and you get no ads, which I think is a key selling point these days. And also access to episodes a few days early and
access to bonus episodes.
And if you want banter and still have Facebook, we've got a special Unsung podcast.
Triple A.
Group which you can join. And hey man, we're not going to kick you out of that either once you leave, if you stop paying for whatever a month.
You're a made person
yeah,
at that point. But above that there is a tier for the record club, whereby we curate every month albums. We buy them directly from the bands and or labels, so the money that we get from you goes partly to support the podcast and then partly directly to these artists and independent labels to help them continue doing what they're doing. It's a really, really good way to kind of share the love a wee bit, and you get something out of it. You get music that you almost certainly won't find otherwise, because we do go far and wide and we do dig around, and we do base it on your kind of tastes approximately as well. You get a bit of say in that.
Yeah, you get to tell us what you like and we say we think you'll also like this.
So
stop doing that.
clicking my pen like an intellectual.
You're the one that's got to edit it, mate, not me.
So. Yeah, man, sorry. I put my glasses on and look what I start doing. But no, just to reiterate a final time, if you like what we do in this episode, if you get something out of it, it's not going to be a barrel of laughs. It's not going to be a massive shit-slinging piss take. But if you
like...
There
will be some shit-slinging for sure.
Oh, there will be, yeah. But if you appreciate the amount of work that went into this, please, if you're not already subscribed, go along and subscribe. You can also make a one-off contribution. Do that as well. But
yeah, we've also got a PayPal, paypal.me/unsungpod if you want to go to that. Or there's also a donate page on our website at unsungpod.net.
Right, we can put the begging bowl away and we can get serious. And the first thing I am going to say, because we do actually have some listeners from the former Yugoslavia kind of area, the Balkans, Southeast Europe. Context is everything. If you are in one of those areas or if you are from one of those areas, then Turbo Folk is almost certainly not unsung to you.
Yeah, and probably inescapable.
Yeah, exactly. So what is it? I will say, you know how they say don't read the comments? See, when you're researching the history of Turbo Folk and you're on YouTube and you're going for some deep cuts, never has the phrase don't read the comments been more applicable. But that'll make a little bit more sense as we get through this. So Turbo Folk is a neologism. It was coined in the 90s by a performer known as Rambo Amadeus.
Turbo je sistem ubrizgavanja goriva pod pritiskom u cilindar motora sa unutrašnjim sagorijevanjem. Turbo folk je gorenje naroda. Svako pospješivanje tog sagorijevanja je tu.
That is one of a number of excellent names.
I think I was tongue in cheek though in his part, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's a bit of a class act, this guy. We'll talk about him in a little bit more detail later on. The folk in this holds all the connotations of the rural origins of the music, plus some of the populist authenticity. And the prefix turbo implies, let's say, a vastly different intensity and speed or power and delivery. The blend of those two sounds represent two different audiences in what we would call the former Yugoslavia. One was traditional and rural and generally conservative, you know, same goes for the UK, same goes for the USA. Your rural audiences tend to be a bit more conservative. And the other is a kind of Western-facing and modern, more urban population.
So, it's interesting that, isn't it? Because there is always a tension between those two groups. There is always,
absolutely,
even in this country now, there still is, right? In Scotland, there is now. And it seems to me very much as Turbo Folk is trying to somehow resolve that tension that's come as a breakup of after the breakup of Yugoslavia. You know what I mean?
It does, but it also owes its fame to that exact tension.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it came to serve a very notorious purpose that we'll explain. The British cultural theorist Alexei Munro calls the phenomenon of Turbo Folk porno nationalism. A Belgrade media theorist Ivana Kronja refers to its look as aggressive, sadistic and pornographically eroticised iconography, and she makes a connection between Turbo Folk and, quote, war profiteering, crime and weapons, cult, rule of force and violence. Vlad Beronja is writing for a very, very interesting site, which is www.scalar.usc.edu. That site is basically all dedicated to the phenomenon of Turbo Folk, covering it from just a myriad different angles, and it's a really, really useful resource that we'll go back to a number of times in this show. And they describe how explicit, threatening and deviant sexuality remains a dominant feature of both texts and music videos, where both female and male bodies are framed, fragmented and displayed as fetish objects for viewers' consumption. The dominant lyrical motifs of love, patriotism and kafana culture have been transformed into more contemporary themes of clubbing culture, display of wealth, as well as criminal activity and sexual transgression. All of which is to say that Turbo Folk is a modernisation of a classic folk music that was really prevalent in the Southeast Europe, in the Balkan area, in Yugoslavia. And it has acquired a notoriety that we'll unpack shortly, but the notoriety is one of, it's associated with extreme nationalism in its heyday, which was sort of the 90s. But that's when it rose to prominence, and we'll explain how it rose to prominence at that time. But then it's continued now into the modern era, and it's become almost a kind of campy version of extreme gangster rap with, you know, rings and watches and cars and bling, and it's got a very OTT eccentric materialistic,
very much so,
vibe to it.
I think it's important to note as well that, that those things you're talking about there, the materialism and the crass consumerist aspect of it, that's by design. You know, that was created by design.
Absolutely.
And we will unpack that as we go through this, but that was a part of a cultural project.
Yep.
And I think it's important to underline that.
Yeah. So there are different variations in Turbo Folk, and people that are younger will probably see a much more benign, slightly trashy, sort of a Love Island-esque sort of Turbo Folk. You know, if you imagine some of the stars of Turbo Folk, they are the kind of people that would be in Celebrity Love Island. But the Turbo Folk that I think first attracted me to the subject was this much, much, much darker variation that grew in the late 80s and in the 1990s. On the flip side of it, Uroš Djvoro, and can I just say, we have tried our very best to learn a little bit of pronunciation for this episode. Some of it will seem more Serbian than Croatian, which in itself is going to be a little bit divisive. I'm sorry, I don't speak the lingo, but we have tried to at least attempt to get some of these names right. We're not going to get them right. Feel free to make fun of us. In fact, why not give us £4 a month, come on the AAA page and make fun of us direct to our faces. Quite happy with that, but we've done our best. So Uroš Djvoro, in their book Turbo Folk Music from 2016, it's a good book, is keen to point out that the full picture of Turbo Folk music is much, much bigger than the role it has been fetishised for. Subjectivity is key. Perceptions of the genre are extremely varied, especially in the Balkans. Turbo Folk took different paths in Serbia to elsewhere because its huge profile there was largely owed to the Slobodan Milosevic regime. As a result, Croatians and others often have different attitudes towards it and even different names for it, including Čajka. I would say C-A-J-K-E, but it's a letter that we don't actually have. It's initially a more pejorative term. We'll come back to that. After the initial titillation value of Turbo Folk as a subject, it feels kind of important to look beyond that. You know, it's worth discussing it for way more than that kitschy shock value. That's part of why this episode's been such an undertaking, because it would have been really easy to do a kind of bite-sized thing where we're just like, look at these fucking crazy Balkan maniacs, look at the stuff they do. But this is a much richer subject than that. Turbo Folk is emblematic of the dramatic political changes in that region, including the violent end of socialist Yugoslavia and the region's transition from state socialism to, quote, ethically unfettered capitalism, which is kind of gangster culture that really was rampant at a certain period. To many in the urban intelligentsia, Turbo Folk epitomises the transformation of the Yugoslav body politic into little more than a kitschy, violent, ultra-nationalist spectacle under Milosevic, something really obscene. And one major piece of evidence that would support the above is something that we will talk about in a bit more, a good bit of detail, the televised marriage between Čeča, who is basically the biggest face in Turbo Folk, the queen of Turbo Folk, and Arkan. And this marriage was branded a Serbian fairy tale, cementing the connection between Turbo Folk, violent militias, and the criminal elite in Serbia. Because Arkan, if that name is familiar, it's because we used to see pictures of him on the news, and it was all to do with ethnic cleansing and his tigers, and his, really a pretty fearsome figure. But he was married to the biggest figure in this music. And it was a publicly celebrated event, full of all this crappy, tacky stuff.
And a lot of, they had like costume changes, you know, between the pure super materialistic and hyper-capitalist, and then also back to the folky and the...
We'll talk about that wedding actually in a wee bit of detail, because there's a lot of symbolism in it as well, and it was all deliberate. A lot of this stuff is actually very deliberate.
Yeah, we'll talk about Pink TV, which is why it became so prominent, you know.
Turbo Folk has survived that period and those associations, and has even propagated But in 2011, for example, the Tuborg Ultimate Summer Festival in Belgrade went head to head with a huge Turbo Folk Festival on the exact same night. I mean, nearby, pitting, you know, huge draws like Moby and Amy Winehouse, who were playing that Tuborg Festival, against this Turbo Folk event. This was very shortly before Amy Winehouse's death, actually. I think it was about a month or so. And the organisers of the Turbo Folk event did not even seem worried about the potential clash of two such huge festivals in the same vicinity on the same night. And right enough, there were like tens of thousands of tickets sold for both of them, which I think also possibly suggests a slight variation in audience there. You got Western facing music, Moby, Amy Winehouse, stuff like that. And then you've got this Turbo Folk audience. What is that Turbo Folk audience? I'm sure we can immediately think of analogies to do with American music audiences. We'll come back to that.
It's also, I don't know if you've got in your notes there, but they're about Croatia and the Billboard charts when they launched the Billboard chart in 2022. All but a handful of the acts that were the most popular in the top 35 are all Turbo Folk artists.
Yeah, and that's in Croatia.
And it's in Croatia.
Which was very much opposed to Serbia, where a lot of Turbo Folk originated. So yeah, we will go into that. So I think maybe we could use the analogy of the good, the bad and the ugly, albeit in reverse. The ugly of Turbo Folk, this is the hot button stuff. Here's some words. Quote, "Why do you need food anyways? How many more Ramadans do you think you'll have?
Corridor.
Muslim degenerate. We will carry out a massacre, slaughter the Albanians, murder the Wahhabis. Anyone resisting gets impaled on a stake." Nema više turskih pita od posavskog zlatog žita.
So you're talking about the band Corridor there, right?
Yeah, we're talking about just one act and of many. And these lyrics come from a very popular Turbo Folk song at a time when villages were being burned and families were being massacred by militias led by a gangster whose wedding was shown in state TV.
There's a timeline difference there, right? The song you're talking about came in 1992.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, roughly around about the start of the wars.
No, it's not. I mean, the wars had already been underway for a good while. There were already incidences of ethnic cleansing happening at that time. It's just in terms of the... It's just I want to underline that this is not a fringe thing.
Yeah, definitely.
The charts had lyrics, like, or if not the charts, popular music had lyrics like that in it. And it was not even particularly unusual in that period.
Do you know, it's quite interesting. I don't know if you went down this rabbit hole as much as I did, but if you go on Reddit, there's a lot of people that are asking about some of the most popular Turbo Folk songs from this era, usually Westerners or people who are maybe from the Balkans or the families of the Balkans that moved to the West.
Yeah.
I think for younger generations, a little bit of fetishization of this music has been kitchen campy and all. It's kind of weird. It sounds kind of awful, but also I like it ironically. Mm-hmm. Because usually when inevitably when that conversation happens, there's always people that'll pop in there saying, like, you don't really understand what this is about, do you? Or you don't really know, like, the meaning behind a lot of this stuff, or even if you do, you clearly don't care. You know, there's a lot of, even if you go on Spotify and Google, just type in Turbo Folk and look at the playlists, there's loads of playlists which are just like fucking meme heavy.
Yeah.
You know?
It's totally meme worthy music, yeah. Especially when it's, you know, in a language that a minority of people speak. Mm. It sort of takes the edge away from it. Something that is just absurd.
Absolutely, but I think there might be some people that will come across these episodes and think that, oh, maybe I'll get to hear some really good tunes or some stuff that I've not heard about it, do you know what I mean? I think it's probably really critical for us to underline that we are not fetishizing this music.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? People are doing that. That is out there on the internet. People are currently undertaking that project, you know?
Well, actually, yeah, not even just in the obscure parts of the internet.
Yeah.
So we'll get to that very shortly because the bad of Turbo Folk, we've done the ugly. The bad, as Vice described it, quote, "Music by criminals for criminals." In a slightly lighter hearted sense, you've got crap music with crap album covers. One of my favourites was like a farmer in a leather jacket on a red Suzuki superimposed upon his own giant face. Just trashy, absurd stuff like that. You've got the male gaze and the prevalence of extensive plastic surgery. You've got extreme levels of rap braggadocio. You've got a lot of misogyny. The acts often like to be seen as wealthy gangsters. There's a little bit of denial at play there because this is amidst hyper-inflation inflation for much of the time we're talking about. But unlike rap, this genre also straddles extreme nationalist sentiments and xenophobia. As, you know, I'm sure we all know, some rap and other genres glorify violence and, you know, black metal, nationalism, racism. But none are so mainstreamed as Turbo Folk was in this part of the world at the time. It is not a fringe genre. If we were to say the good, we will highlight the good, because this is not just, you know, rubbernecking. There are aspects, especially in some of the modern output, that seem positive. Modern turbo folk seen as championing LGBTQ causes. It's also seen as moving towards female empowerment. Although I caveat that by saying I'm sure that second and third wave feminists probably disagree quite a bit. Turbo folk is endured as a pan-national musical tradition in the region. It looks to maintain some aspects of rural culture that were otherwise lost amidst sort of Western cultural imperialism. So from our perspective, Mark highlighted here, we're not trying to fetishise this. It's a bit like the Ace of Base episode. I kind of arrived initially at this subject due to the most shocking and clickable aspects of Turbo Folk. You know, the things that you see that you're like, what? Fucking hell. But we have unearthed a more nuanced story. It's a phenomenon we need to examine and unpack. We want to be insightful and avoid too much weird voyeurism. And what we're going to do here will be shocking at points, but we'll try and make it balanced and avoid any morbid enthusiasm. Vice TV was criticised for approaching the subject in just such a cynical manner as we are trying to avoid. So I think maybe highlight that to begin with here, that Vice Guide to the Balkans from 2009, specifically part two of this five-part mini-series they did.
Turbo Folk started in the roadhouse bars dotting Serbia's highways before migrating to the city and becoming the country's biggest export after war crimes.
This Vice video met with a fair amount of hostility for emphasising the brutal and lowbrow aspects of Turbo Folk. I already used the quote from that, made for criminals by criminals. Some other quotes. It isn't unusual for Turbo Folk stars to be arrested with a trunk full of cocaine or machine guns. Well, I can tell you that is still quite unusual, regardless of Turbo Folk or not. Turbo Folk is tacky, high-octane techno with melodies based loosely on the traditional Balkan folk music, which would make it the same as popular music in pretty much any country in Europe if it wasn't also paid for by the Serbian and Croatian mafias and served as a soundtrack to some of the most heinous war crimes since the Holocaust.
There's a kernel of truth in that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not completely false, but it's Vice playing it for clicks.
Hyperbolic.
Vice were criticised for the choice of their guide in that. It's a musician called Goga Sekulic. And apparently it's a bit like asking Kim Kardashian to give you a cultural tour of LA. They were also criticised for not mentioning that Turbo Folk has not only survived that era, Milosevic, but has grown in popularity across the Balkans and not just in Serbia. To be fair, the show's musical expert is a Corneli Kovac, I think his name is pronounced, Kovac. He gives a fairly astute summary of the genre when he says you take a few folk music techniques and tropes, add a 90s beat and a young girl with big breasts who may or may not be able to sing, and market it to folk from the countryside. And that's kind of hitting the nail on the head. There is no question that the Vice documentary and our initial interests are probably driven a bit by the sense of the wild and exotic aspect of the Balkans, because coming from Western Europe, where I grew up, watching the images that were coming out of that, it was so alien. There was a morbid curiosity and a fascination, and I think it's maybe even forgivable and natural that you would be so curious about such a violent place that was so close by and seemed so familiar in so many other ways. You know, if you go to Croatia or Zagreb or Belgrade now, these feel like quite familiar cities.
Yeah,
different in many other ways, but it was totally understandable to be wondering what caused Yugoslavia to erupt in horrific violence on numerous occasions. And I think we do need to answer that question to understand how Turbo Folk could contribute.
There's a bit of bit of romanticism there almost, you know, and also a bit of orientalism. It's like we're looking towards the Wild East and thinking, well, how could it, it's like an alternate reality because it looks like it could be another European city. Is it another European city? But it looks like any other European city, but it's mad.
They're guilty of that themselves.
There's totally.
There's a concept called nesting Balkanism that we'll talk about later, where basically the country next to you in the East is more primitive than you.
The reason I brought that up is because at some point further down this conversation, we're going to talk about invented realities.
Yeah.
And Scots have been a part of and being party to that. But it's a mental note for me to basically inject some local experience and culture into that from our own history.
Primary research. I do think it's unavoidable that we'll have to take a quick tour along the recent timeline and history of the Balkans, because it will be important to kind of place all the stuff that we're going to talk about and why it's significant. So it is time for a basic history lesson, so buckle in. Yugoslavia and the wars. So it's easy for you to refer to this as a monolithic war in the former Yugoslavia, but we're actually faced with between 4 to maybe 7 different conflicts and insurgencies that spanned more than a decade. That's relevant because the culture of propaganda and hyper-nationalism did not just come before or after, but also during those conflicts, including during key lulls. Propaganda, which includes turbo folk in that situation, served not just to reflect hatred arising from the war, but to actually refuel and exacerbate those inter-ethnic tensions, again, especially during the lulls in the action.
Can I just jump in a wee bit here and add a thought?
Yeah.
It also kind of serves a bit of a desire for some of the people that were in charge, I suppose, to kind of re-traditionalise the response to the rapid urbanisation that was happening. You know, that rapid explosion of gangster capitalism, you know, that whole traditional life is disrupted.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's going to play a big part in this. But I think having a rough idea of this timeline will help the discussion as we go. And at the very least, it might be useful on a pub quiz sometime. We should bear in mind, going all the way back to that in that region, that it was actually a bullet from a guy called Gavrilo Princip. He was a member of the Serbian nationalist group, the Black Hand, that killed Franz Ferdinand and started World War I. Yugoslavia came about in 1918 after the end of that war. There were many ethnic tensions, more assassinations in the 1920s because of a very complex religious and political makeup in that region. From about 1929 to 1945, a very important thing took place, which is that a Croatian fascist organisation called the Ustasha advocated the genocide of the Serbs, largely along sort of Catholic Orthodox church lines. Because that's the thing as well, you've got different Christian groups here that really fucking don't like each other, as well as Muslim communities, as well as many more. And they did that whilst they were creating the Greater Croatia across much of the Northern Balkans. They also, the Ustasha, willingly took part in the ethnic cleansing of Jews, Roma and perceived communists in collaboration with the Nazis, thanks to, well, shared beliefs around racial superiority, basically. And I mean, in Serbia, there was also a complicit government, but Serbia also became kind of known for its partisan resistance movements. I mean, even the football team Partizan Belgrade still carries that name. And a lot of left-wing Serbian resistance in turn exacted violent reprisals, both during and after the war. The Ustasha effectively dissolved, and I think a lot of them actually just fled the country because they were fearing punishment following the defeat of the Nazis. And in 45, a guy called Josip Broz Tito established the Federal People's Republic of Yugoslavia. Very strong authoritarian rule that helped him suppress basically most overt expressions of nationalism. It was all kept under wraps. He's got one famous statement that goes, no one questioned who is a Serb, who is a Croat, who is a Muslim. We were all one people. That's who it was back then, and I still think it's that way today.
Did that in Albania as well.
But following his death in 1980, relations between those nationalities deteriorated really quickly. Worth noting here as well that neo-folk and what they call newly composed folk music, NCFM, also grew in popularity at that time. And we'll look at some of the structural and social trends, as Mark was saying, that accelerated that.
Život bez tebe, dragi, ka drugu ljubav ne želim da ima. Sanjam te, sanjam skoro svake noći.
Many of us, as I said, will also remember the pictures of the Yugoslav war from TV as kids. It was seemingly unending. I mean, these conflicts, they were different conflicts, but they went on for a decade. And when you're a kid, you can't really follow who's fighting who now, but you did hear a lot of the same names coming up. The main conflicts were as follows. 1991, there was a thing called the Slovenian War of Independence. 10-day war, Slovenia seceded for the former Yugoslavia, and it was actually relatively bloodless. The Yugoslav state forces didn't really put up much resistance. However, 1991 to 1995 was the Croatian War Independence. Their first president, a guy called Tudman, he was elected in 1990 and he made independence one of his objectives. Croatia immediately sought to remove socialist from its name via that independence. Croatia's history of right-wing allegiances, as we just discussed, fostered a lot of animosity between themselves and the Serbians. Croatia also removed Cyrillic from official use and platformed a bunch of quite nationalist policies that were hostile to Serbians and the socialist Yugoslav legacy. Language does play a big part in this. Alphabets, actually, in this case as well, Latin versus Cyrillic. And by removing that alphabet from circulation, it was a clear form of cultural oppression. Fighting in Croatia actually began a few weeks before Slovenia had seceded. The Serbs within Croatia had also declared their own intent to secede if Croatia seceded. Ethnic tensions ramped up over 1990 and 1991 via propaganda, which included the likes of music and, in this case, Turbo Folk. And by summer, the Serbs had boycotted an independence referendum, and a bunch of armed skirmishes then developed into an all-out civil war. That civil conflict was supplied on one side by the JNA, which is, again, as I said, Serbia's state, you know, Slobodan Milosevic's military arm, who had previously insisted that both Slovenia and Croatia disarm before they could discuss independence. A UN arms embargo in the region as well left the Croatians largely helpless because the Serbs were still being provided with weapons by Milosevic. In 92 to 95, you had the Bosnian War. It's a further conflict that ran in tandem, partly with the Croatian one. That erupted when Bosnia-Herzegovina moved to secede from what was left of Yugoslavia. There was actually internal conflict between three fucking groups there, the Bosniaks, the Serbs, who were trying to establish a breakaway republic called, I think it's pronounced Republic Srpska, and a Croat force that were trying to establish a third partition. It was an absolute clusterfuck. That conflict became the bloodiest and the most notorious of the 1990s conflicts. Things that we'll probably recognise, like the siege of Sarajevo, the massacre at Srebrenica, was covered a lot in the news.
A friend of mine, very talented poet, we did a creative writing as our final year dissertation, and he decided to do a collection of poetry based on the massacre at Srebrenica.
Well,
he basically had a complete fucking mental collapse.
Yeah.
In the end, he didn't even turn in any poetry. His final dissertation was basically just like an actual dissertation about why he couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And all the things he learned along the way.
That's fascinating, eh? Quite a meta study of his own struggle with the subject, yeah. I mean, you're talking about concentration camps in Southeast Europe at this point, like horrendous stuff. In 1995, there was the Kosovan insurgency. So you've got Albania, you've also got Kosovo, which is another region. Go look at a map. The Kosovar Albanians had been heavily discriminated against since the repeal of the Yugoslav constitution in 1990. They were fired from things like public jobs, and the Albanian language and culture were repressed by Milosevic's state forces. As a result, the KLA formed. The KLA became quite regularly discussed on the news over here, and they began an insurgency campaign that it ramped up across the remainder of the decade and actually led to a bunch of coordinated attacks on the police and state facilities. And then in 1998 until 99, you had the Kosovo War. NATO had brokered a ceasefire, but that was breached by the mass murder of 45 Kosovar Albanians in a place called Racek. And it led NATO to the conclusion that they had to send in peacekeepers. So forces went in. That also then led to the NATO bombing of Belgrade, which is a huge moment. It's interesting because the tightly controlled state media, as you would expect, I guess, in hindsight with an authoritarian regime, the state media in Serbia did not allow the reporting of the atrocities by their own forces. So when NATO bombed Belgrade, they were incredulous. The sense of outrage and just shock to us seemed, it's like, well, what? Don't get me wrong, it's still a big decision, but they had no understanding of the premise for this. And this moment still actually has real implications, not just for Serbia and the Balkans, but also, for example, for the behaviour of Russia, which depicts those airstrikes as a violent NATO incursion into a Russian sphere of influence. Putin in particular took it, he took great exception to the action. He saw it as a sign of disrespect. It features often in his justification for anti-Western sentiment. I think he was really, really critical of Boris Yeltsin at the time for not reacting more strongly. So that wasn't even the end of it. From about 2000 to 2002, there were further kind of smaller conflicts and insurgencies, some involving ethnic Albanian groups. And I think in particular, there was a war. Is it classed as a war with Macedonia? So it's a lot to digest. But what you have there is a decade of various eruptions of either insurgencies, all-out wars, or both across these different territories. And these different groups all had different identities, they all had different traditions and different versions of the truth, different stories, different fucking alphabets, different languages, but they also had an awful lot in common. And that's kind of what's so strange here. Just to very quickly go back, as we said, you're talking about a type of music that was used to kind of enable and fuel ethnic cleansing, and yet to this day, it's still the biggest form of pop music in the areas that were subject to that ethnic cleansing, which is pretty astonishing. So with that context established, I think we can also maybe establish a bit about Yugoslavian music under Tito and also as the wars approached. So Yugoslavia enjoyed like a neo-folk movement. As I mentioned the phrase earlier on, newly composed folk music, NCFM. That was a really big thing in Eastern Europe in the 1970s, with a kind of post-modern approach to traditional sounds. I mean, there's Western parallels, right? They maybe came slightly earlier, I guess, like Bob Dylan, Donovan, popular new twists on classic sort of themes. Something that does distinguish the area, though, in the 1980s, the Yugoslav communist government had a kitsch tax. In this context, kitsch kind of means contrived, its usage. They basically reviewed works of music, art, writing, and appraised them based on their loose cultural and social goals. So, you know, was it worthy of a good communist citizen? Was it high or low art? They didn't much like that NCFM. It wasn't seen as being sophisticated enough. It was deemed low art. The literary value of the songs, the musical patterns, incidences of plagiarism, and things that fell foul of those kind of rulings were subject to a higher rate of tax, and that forced them to sell at a higher price, and in turn made them less accessible to the everyman, who was probably the exact person that wanted to get this music. And that tax was eventually abolished in the early 80s following Tito's death. It had shown both the hostility to art, but also reflected the state's attitudes towards working class culture. You know, that working class culture was distanced from official approved culture. So neo-folk and then turbo-folk came to also kind of represent a rebellion against the communist dogma and a win for those marginalised and repressed groups and identities. So class is very relevant, and internal disputes within the society along those lines are important. During the time period that neo-folk and then turbo-folk was coming into the mainstream, which is, you know, the 60s all the way through to the 90s, they were and generally still are considered to be music for the working class. Neo-folk had found an audience amongst the kind of southern post-war industrialisation of the Balkans that Mark was talking about earlier. As rural people moved to the urban settings, it helped to unite those communities, it helped to maintain their ties. So the argument is made that neo-folk and then turbo-folk as its descendant were a kind of pushback against the erosion of working class culture, because Yugoslavia, socialist Yugoslavia, sought to modernise, and the rural and working class communities were left really disorientated and facing a bit of an identity crisis. And so this music, as was in so many different cultures, was something they could kind of hang on to. Somebody called Zika Jaksic is the owner of the Zvezdagranda label, which might come up in your notes, Mark. It's a famous turbo folk label, and he's highlighted the class snobbery of the genre's origins, describing the 90s as, quote, an unfortunate time when anyone with adequate funds could break into the field. It was enough to sell a cow to finance your talent or lack of talent. And to be fair, when you see the album covers from that time, it very much does look like somebody's sold a cow to record an album.
A lot of the album covers are just like guys in military uniforms doing a portrait.
Yeah, just standing in the street. Yeah, not staged, taking on like a disposable camera. Yeah. So yeah, there is definitely a condescending class aspect to it there, even from a guy running a turbo folk label. Even in the Balkans, you know, turbo folk soon acquired the role of a guilty pleasure. As Uroš Čvoro says in that book, Turbo Folk Music, people would claim to only listen to it when they were drunk or only listen to the good stuff, but not the trash. But he does point out that the clubs were always full and the tours were always sold out. So somebody was not telling the truth.
Everybody was always drunk, maybe?
Well, actually, maybe there is a bit to that. Even at the time, you know, other artistic movements, film, for example, and movies that contain neo-folk and turbo-folk frequently also utilise those class stereotypes. That's backed up by, they call it the Yugoslavian, the Black Wave cinema movement. It was in the 60s and 70s, and it was a movement in cinema there that was very satirical and quite critical of the establishment. And so, for example, the film I Even Met a Happy Gypsy is based around a kafana singer and her totally violent, drunken ex-partner who gets into knife fights and things. And it just shows, like, you know, that's them saying, these are the people that listen to this stuff. This is the culture this represents. But to be fair, those dynamics were true across the ethnic subdivisions of the region at a time. It wasn't just in Serbia. An oft-quoted writer called Eric D. Gordy wrote a thing called The Culture of Power in Serbia, and turbofolk became an agent of nationalism in order to unite Yugoslavia in the midst of fraught relations as well. But its role changed over time, and it became largely attributed to Serbia and Serbian culture. Obviously, we'll explain why, but that's due to it being appropriated by the Milosevic regime. So turbofolk was significant within Yugoslavia in defining aspects of class and distinctions between rural and urban culture. But there were other outward-looking aspects to its significance as well. One of them, I would say, anti-capitalist, anti-neoliberal sentiment became a big thing. Uroš Čvoro again writes in Turbo Folk Music that, quote, its primitiveness and backwardness became the means of resisting globalisation, and Turbo Folk became the soundtrack for a pan-Balkan transnational identity deprived of all nationalist elements. Turbo Folk's iconography is also perceived as a, quote, genuinely Balkan form of resistance to the threat of neoliberalism, which is something that you get in a lot of cultures that have rapidly industrialised, where the working class, especially in the face of like Western Europe and America being so notoriously affluent, they saw this as imperialism, and this was a way to push back against that as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the main things that I think in modern society that's currently, that is always at odds with nationalism, is globalisation, right?
Yeah.
And there are a lot of things that you can be anti-globalist and not be a nationalist, that is possible. Sorry, you can be anti-globalisation and not a nationalist.
Yeah.
Globalist is a completely different thing. So that is totally possible. But in this particular instance, it kind of goes back to, oh, we're talking about tradition here. Mm-hmm. We're going back to traditions, the things that we're railing against, even though it's a country that's becoming increasingly hyper-capitalist and rapaciously so. There's a dissonance there.
Yeah. But Uroš Čvoro was actually something of a defender of the genre. I mean, he contests that, quote, turbo folk was never overtly nationalist, however its aesthetics aligned with the interests of nationalists.
I mean, can e-music be just one thing? No.
Probably not, yeah. But I think it is often depicted as that. And so he's maybe just making that point. On that note, as mentioned, the association with the working and rural class, he's achieved a few things. The first one is, given the Tito era suppression, it made the sound seem liberating and anti-authoritarian. Mm. It set it up in opposition to modernising forces, so both social and economic. it nurtured ideas of patriotism, the authentic identity, ties to the land. But all of that also made it rife for exploitation. Cue the next chapter in it. As we said, Tito died in 1980. Post-Tito, enter Slobodan Milosevic. By contrast to Tito, Slobodan Milosevic actually ploughs kind of a similar electoral furrow to Trump. So Tito's socialism had relied on the input, or at least the complicity, of intellectual elites such as me, people who wear glasses. Mm-hmm. Milosevic was very different. He appealed to the rural poor, the poorly educated, a sense of resentment and grievance towards urban elites. It's a very Trumpist approach, you know, getting away from the coastal elites, all that kind of thing. He used animosity towards the bourgeoisie, and so low art, you know, quote unquote, was a logical thing to utilise. You can see, again, parallels in Trump appearing at UFC events and baseball and stuff like that. Milosevic, as an authoritarian, was looking to sculpt a culture that enabled his ideology and ambitions, and Turbo Folk was seized upon and became a key part of that process. Mark, you said that earlier. This was an engineering attempt. This is where it became a tool to shape a culture rather than representative. Neo-folk was already part of the rural communal psyche, and so even as the state TV got behind it, really little effort or expense was actually required to boost Turbo Folk into this dominant status. As the wars for the of the 1990s began, there was also an element of cultural isolation that led to Turbo Folk having basically less competition for people's attention. Many international acts avoided Serbia in particular for a long time, and that did begin to change in the early to mid noughties, but it meant that for a long period of time Turbo Folk had a totally outsized role in the popular culture in those areas. So excuse that, it's a little bit of a history lesson, but it is a very fascinating part of the world. Very fucking complicated part of the world. One of the most complicated, maybe not the most. I still think the Middle East maybe claims that title, but it's not far off it. And the genesis of this music wasn't linear. It was certainly seized upon. It became a useful device for malign ends. So I think we'll break there. And then when we come back, I think we should see Turbo Folk in action in that period, what Milosevic was able to achieve with it, how it was received, how it influenced society, and unfortunately some of the lowlights of the genre in that moment.
Great.
Great. Can he wait for that bit, can yeah. you? You've read the lyrics, Mark.
I know. See you next episode.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.